You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Hi, I'm Joe Heath.
I'm Tony Heath.
And this is the Watchathon of Rassilon.
Yep.
We're going to be talking about the first serial of the 14th season of Doctor Who, The Mask of Mandragora, which I thought it was Mandragora, but it seems like they were pronouncing it Mandragora. I'm not sure. I'm probably still mispronouncing it. But it consists of four episodes that aired from September 4th, 1976 to September 25th, 1976.
True facts!
And I want to give a special shout out to Matt Golden for getting us this episode.
Hey, thanks, Matt.
You can follow him on Tumblr at mgoldentumbles.tumblr.com. And today we have a new guest joining us. It is R. Allen Seiler.
Hi there. How's it going?
Going good. How's it going with you?
Oh, you know, just dandy. Ready to talk about some Doctor Who.
Sweet. But first, let's talk about you. Tell everyone who you are and where they may know you from.
My name's Alan, and I am one of the co-runners of Wholanta, which is a Doctor Who convention, obviously, in Atlanta, thus the name. I've been doing that for 13 years. Next one is coming up next May. We are in prep for that. We have one guest so far announced, and are working on additional ones. So it's going to be a big year.
Exciting. We've been 3 years.
Yeah, it's been awesome every time.
And we've done podcasts there 2 years, so. And it's my favorite con that I've been to, so.
Yeah.
Aw, yay. That's awesome.
I've been to smaller cons, and I've been to bigger cons, and it's like, it's the perfect size.
Just right.
Yeah, exactly. It's like porridge.
It's not bare bones, and it's not overwhelming, so it's really, really good. I can't recommend it enough.
Aw, thanks.
Considering the fact that you run a Doctor Who convention, I imagine you're about to say everything, but we always ask our guests that are on for the first time how much Doctor Who they've seen or read or consumed or whatever, so.
Well, as far as seen, everything, including like reconstructions of the missing ones. I've seen everything, some of them more than others. There's ones that I haven't watched in a long time, and actually Mask of Mandragora, which you did pronounce correctly. Great job.
Yay!
Is one that I actually hadn't watched in a long time. So it was really cool to revisit that. As far as read, most of my Doctor Who reading is nonfiction. I never really got too much into the novels and stuff. I'm familiar with them. I know a lot of the things that happen in them, but I've not read a lot of them. But as far as my like extracurricular Doctor Who, it's Big Finish audios, which I really love. Haven't heard all of them because, oh my God, there are so many of them.
That'd be so impressive.
Wouldn't it, though? And now that, you know, for like 15, 20 years, they had a license only for Classic Who. And about 3 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, they, you know, gained a license to do new series stuff as well. So now there's so much Doctor Who stuff coming out from Big Finish. It's just crazy.
Do you have a favorite era of Big Finish stuff that you like?
Oh, that's hard to say. It's harder to think of Big Finish in that kind of sense as it is the TV show. I love anything that they've done with the Sixth Doctor. I think they've particularly served him well. The Eighth Doctor is amazing. I think a lot of the newer stuff that they've been putting out in the sort of themed box sets, especially with the Paul McGann Doctor, especially things like there's Time War sets that are happening and Dark Eyes and all that stuff is really, really good. The River Song box sets have been really good. So, I mean, I guess my favorite era is now.
Nice. You want to talk about the episode?
Yeah. Let's talk about the serial. The Mask of... I'm going to mess it up now.
Now that
I'm
self-conscious
about it. Yeah. The Mask of Mandragora.
Correct.
Yes.
Good job. Oh, that's awesome.
I don't know why, but like when I saw the title before we watched it, I just assumed it was Mandragora, because that sounds better to me than Mandragora. But
yeah, it takes some getting used to.
But let's dive in. The first episode, which I have titled The Hitchhiker of Mandragora.
I like it.
Do you have titles?
I didn't come up with titles. I'm so sorry.
It's all right.
I'm going to be really super clever, and I'm going to call it Part 1.
Nice.
Tony agrees with you.
No, but I think Hitchhiker is perfect. I think that's good. The Hitchhiker of the unpronounceable alien name.
Before the episode even starts, we get slightly new intro. The font has changed. I really like the new font.
Fantastic. It's
we are getting into real detail on this one.
You actually should have seen how he like gasped and he was like, "Is that a new font?" And I was like, I don't know.
It has slightly like, more personality.
It's delightful.
In fact, I think they went from 10-point type to 12-point type just to match Tom Baker's growing ego.
My dad was went to school for graphic design, and I had to hear about fonts.
It's true. He'll point them out to you when you're like out somewhere. You're like looking at a menu. He's like, "Oh my god, I can't believe they used this font." I'll be like, "Ah, that's a good one. That's a good solid font right there."
So I'm at least marginally more aware of fonts now. So, that's not the only thing that's new though. We get new TARDIS stuff.
Oh my gosh! I think like last episode, I was talking about how much I love when we see more like interior of the TARDIS. And so like this one opens with them just like walking around and Sarah Jane being like, "Where even are we?"
Like, right. And he's like, "The boot cupboard." And she's like, "What?" Because this is, you know, another entire living room. But no, it's the boot cupboard.
Just some boots propped in front of a like CSO screen.
But I think what's great is they go into the old control room. And it looks way cooler than any control room set we've ever had before. But I still really, I really like it. And Sarah Jane picks up the recorder.
Yes. And I think one of Three's jackets might be hanging around, too.
Really?
With a frilly shirt. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't see that.
It's a more moody console. Like, it's darker. Like, the colors are darker and everything. Yeah.
It's an attempt at more atmosphere. It's a much warmer set.
It reminds me of, like, a scaled-down Eighth Doctor.
Oh, yeah. Without a doubt. Without a doubt. And I think the first time I saw the Eighth Doctor movie back in 96, that's the first thing I thought of was sort of like a bigger, you know, grander, larger budget version of the Tom Baker season 14 console, which I thought was wonderful.
Isn't there even some like little stained glass windows?
Yes, there is. I don't know where the sunlight's coming from. He just has like lights behind it or something. I don't know. But yeah, there are. It's a mini cathedral.
Right before they go into the new TARDIS room, there's a really adorable back and forth between him and Sarah Jane, where she's talking about the size of everything. He's basically like, size doesn't matter in space or whatever.
They're talking about dimensions.
Dimensions, yeah. And he's like,
in infinity, everything's basically the same.
And he's like, "I don't even know why I bothered with you humans." And she's like, "Because you have good taste." And he's like, "That is true."
it's definitely that.
There was such a great chemistry between the two of them. You know, and that's why I think that especially the American audience tends to gravitate toward them. Those of us who were, you know, are fans of a certain age, back in the PBS days, pretty much all you saw were the Tom Baker stories, and the Fourth Doctor and Sarah Jane were so iconic. And I think a lot of the reason why is because of the chemistry that they have. They are so natural together, and they have such a warmth between them.
We're going through it for the first time, and they're already, like, top tier for me. Like, up there with Two and Jamie, so.
They call each other best friends for the second time in the serial. Which we're up to the second count, and every time I'm like, they're best friends.
That is definitely something that becomes more prevalent during Tom. I can't recall any of the other doctors ever saying that. And he mostly only says it with Sarah Jane. He did refer to Leela one time, at least one time that way. But you really see it with he and Liz Sladen. Like, they just have a magic about them.
Yeah.
I am down for it. But they pull up the scanner and they see a really cool blue swirly effect. That is the Mandragora Helix, which is apparently got some intelligence at the center of it. They said some like techno babble. I didn't fully follow exactly what it was. Some space anomaly thing?
Yeah, it's a big space thing.
Space-time
full of
thing?
Full of energy. That's what you gotta know.
Space thing.
I just knew at this point it was like, Doctor Who's about to go weird, and I always enjoy when Doctor Who goes weird, like the Mind Robber or...
There's a few Pertwee ones that get kind of strange, where he steps out of the TARDIS and he's in sort of a vortex-y kind of thing, and then the Master's there, and they're like having this chat in like a vortex thing, and it just gets nutty.
Doctor Who cannot do that enough. I love it every time they do something like that.
Yeah, there's not enough of that stuff in the new series.
It should just be more like experimental, just trying
like,
stuff.
What are you doing? Yeah, that's always the most fun. But they kind of get sucked into this intelligent vortex, and when they land in, like, this void.
Surround it. There's also, like, these, like, crystal necklaces, basically, just layered around.
The crystal necklace of Mandragora.
And there's just a little tiny TARDIS in the center of it. Also, when they're going through it, it's, like, affecting Sarah Jane, and she has to, like, concentrate her brain or whatever to do that. She says the alphabet backwards, which means I have to say the alphabet backwards.
All right, all right.
Okay, go.
ZYXWVUTSRQPONMLKJIHGFEDCBA.
You did that far more effortlessly than she did.
Yeah, she had to think about it.
She really did. So I don't think it would have helped you very much.
Yeah, but you wouldn't have to focus at all.
Second nature to me.
You sound very practiced.
It'd probably be harder for you to count backwards from 100.
Yeah, that's probably true.
You know, when someone asks me to say the alphabet backwards, I just turn around and then say it the right way.
That's clever. I learned how to say it backwards from a Reno 911 sketch.
Nice.
I don't think that, like, that advice was supposed to actually work.
Yeah. Well, it was like a live bit they did on stage where he was just, like, teaching the audience how to get out of a... like drunk driving tickets. He's like, you gotta learn how to say the alphabet backwards, and then gave like little mnemonics for all of it. So
now you know it forever now.
Yeah. I mean, ZYX is the obvious one. Then West Virginia, Utah, WVUT. That's our Q to P on Martin Luther King. SRQPONMLK. Jig, but spelled wrong. JIHG. Fed, FED, and then CBA. And I've remembered it to this day.
Wow.
That's such a ridiculous way to remember it.
It works.
There's so much thought process that has to go into that, though.
And, yeah, you can say it so fast. Are you thinking when you say it?
Sometimes, but not always.
Anyway.
Boy, what a off track we got there. That's all right. But it relates to the episode, at least.
A little bit.
Mostly, it's just showing off.
If you're ever trapped in the Mandragora Helix, you'll know. Just do that over and over and over, and you'll be fine.
But they're inside the helix at the center of it, I guess. And
there's a little fireball.
Yeah, that's like heading straight towards them, and they hide behind the TARDIS. And the Doctor just picks Sarah Jane up and swings her around to the back of the TARDIS to hide from it.
I'm pretty sure in 55 years of televised time travel, this is the only occasion where, when danger is on the way, they hide behind the TARDIS rather than going inside and closing the door.
Hmm, that's very true.
You know, so they run around to the back, leave the door open, and then they're surprised when the helix energy gets in.
Surely that can have no consequences.
Oh, no. There's certainly no causality between those two things.
Sure, the plot won't develop from this moment.
Had they closed the door, it would have been an incredibly short, you know, 5-minute, you know, where the next 3.5 episodes are just nothing.
Just solving the whole medieval plot we're about to get into, but without any, like, sci-fi stuff.
Man, that is my favorite. We start in, like, the void, and you're like, all right, they're doing something weird. And then it, like, immediately cuts to medieval. And you're not in it yet. Like, the Doctor and Sarah Jane aren't in it yet. It's just, like, life.
It's such a big jump, and it's such an odd, unexpected cut to this other, complete other setting, which that's another thing that Doctor Who does so incredibly well. Just blends these different settings and different times into one unit. I love it.
Always love a good historical.
True.
This is a pseudo-historical, too. Is this one of the first pseudo-historicals? Probably not, but...
No, I think we've kind of left the era of, like, actual...
Yeah, we haven't... I don't think
historicals.
We...
Historicals... for a while now.
I don't think we have an actual historical again until, like, the fifth Doctor, I think, is what I heard.
That is correct.
I actually really enjoy the actual historicals, because I sometimes get a little tired of, oh, it's aliens!
We're in
like,
the past,
every time.
But it's aliens. Yeah.
In the new series, you get a lot of that, and I would love to have just a pure historical in the new series and not have to find out that Agatha Christie's disappearance was, you know, down to aliens. It would be nice if it was just a mystery for them to solve rather than having to swat an alien wasp monster, you know.
That's why Countryside is one of my favorite Torchwood episodes.
Me too.
That's one of the things that gives me hope about Chris Chibnall running the show is that specific episode.
Yeah, well, that's the only one, let me tell you.
Everything that I've seen from, like, the marketing stuff that's come out so far, I've been like, oh, that's a good choice. So, as apprehensive as I've been, I am somewhat hopeful.
I am guardedly hopeful.
That's a good way to put it.
I'm not giddy or anything like that, but I'm looking forward to it, but with, you know, the ever so slight hint of reservation, just basically because I haven't really enjoyed that many of Chibnall's episodes. But hey, that's okay.
A fair assessment.
I don't know, he has good stuff in his episodes.
Yeah,
they're just not very tightly written,
like, on the whole. Yeah.
Anyway.
Tangent number two.
It's hard for me not to talk about the new series Doctor when it comes up, when we're in like that just anticipation phase.
So soon.
Oh my gosh, it can't come fast enough.
So we're in the past now. There's some fight scenes happening. They're the sort of the upper class are attacking the lower class.
He's not the Duke, but he's the Duke's uncle. Yes.
Well, current Duke's brother, but the Duke is dying.
Yes.
So the new Duke is his nephew. A lot of family tree going on there, if you can sort that all out. But he is like attacking these like sort of villagers and setting fire to hay and things of that nature.
Just because.
Yeah, why not?
It's just like, you know what? Their lives aren't hard enough.
It's easily combustible. It makes a good, you know, it looks good on screen. So
everybody in this sort of family has the same haircut, this sort of bob going on.
Yes.
Chris Cherry referred to one of them. Oh, the nephew, the one we're about to meet, as Farquaad McScience.
He's a good character. You know, and it's interesting that the two main guest characters, Marco and Giuliano, Tim Pigott-Smith plays Marco, and I've seen him in a ton of things. I don't think I've ever seen, I mean, I don't even know the guy's name who plays Giuliano, but I don't think I've ever seen him in anything else.
I know there's a lot of people in this serial that are from previous serials. For example, you said Marco, right? Or is it Giuliano? Which one's, I can't remember which one's which.
Marco's the red-haired one that's not the Duke.
Yes, okay. He's Tim Pigott-Smith.
Yes.
I've seen him in a bunch of stuff, too. I looked him up afterward, because, like, that name sounds familiar, and I was just like, he's been in a bunch of stuff, like, and I don't remember him in most of it, but I'm like, I've seen that movie for sure, so. I think he was previously on the show as well.
Yeah, he was in Claws of Axos.
Was he a unit soldier?
Maybe. I do remember him in a military uniform, so maybe that's the case.
We meet I'm going to mispronounce all these names. Hieronymus?
Hieronymus.
Yes, Hieronymus. Thank you. I'm so bad at pronouncing things.
So bad at words.
Yes. But he's been on the show previously as well. He was in Doctor Who and the Silurians.
And Abominable Snowman.
Playing a slightly unfortunate role in that one.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Had a Fu Manchu going on, so that'll tell you something. A character we'll meet later who is sort of like in this cult who has like this big head of white hair was in Power of the Daleks as Lesterson.
Listen, Lesterson.
Yes. They're just calling up all the old people. But Hieronymus, I'm saying it wrong. I'm just going to call him Beard Guy because he has a gigantic beard.
And the funny thing is, and we're jumping ahead now, but later on when he's wearing the mask, where does he tuck his beard under into the mask? I mean, because otherwise you would know completely in an instant who it is, but so he must, like, I don't know, hide it somehow.
He must be all smushed up against his face.
He crunches it up into a ponytail, but like a beard ponytail.
Oh, but the family drama here is basically that
the Duke died.
The Duke died.
And he foretold it.
Down to the day, to the minute. And Giuliano is not having any of that. He's like, yeah, that sounds fishy to me, Buster.
Because he believes in science.
not magic and stars, I guess. Because it's all very tied in with astrology. He read the stars and knows what's going to go down. And there's a weird sort of thing involving this because, like, it's pretty much immediately said that, like, the beard guy is in cahoots with the uncle.
Yes.
But also he, like, legitimately believes in the star stuff. But also it seems like he's kind of complicit in this murder.
He's clearly complicit. So I'm like, does anybody really believe what it is that he's saying, including himself? He must, and you know, at least just enough to get wrapped up in this whole Mandragora thing. But clearly he's the one who poisoned the Duke.
Does he think he's fulfilling prophecy?
Exactly. So now, and it's funny too, because later on in the story, Federico, that's his name, says, you know, all these, you know, quote unquote, correct predictions are going to your head. And he's being told, cast the stars and, you know, make this happen. So he's obviously the one who's, you know, the sort of the fall guy for, you know, Federico's dirty business. But he still sort of has that belief that astrology's real, even though he's the one that's making his own predictions happen.
He gets very offended at some point. They get into a kind of a fight, and he's like, you don't believe in my stuff, but it's super real.
I guess he just looks at it more as a instruction manual than, you know.
That could be. That's a good point.
Makes sense.
The uncle character really wants to poison Giuliano, and he's like, make that happen.
He's like, I can't do it yet. Not today.
Yeah, like,
stars say not today.
I will poison him, but not until the stars say that I should.
And then the TARDIS arrives. The doctor says it was a forced landing. He didn't land here on purpose, which is something he rarely admits to.
My favorite joke is here, though, where he's like, maybe that's why I stopped using this one.
And then Sarah Jane goes and eats some oranges, which, does she bite the peel off?
Thank you. Thank you. What kind of oranges do they grow in, I don't know if it's England or medieval times, that don't have a rind on them?
She picks it right off the tree and just bites immediately into it.
Yeah.
I don't understand.
She'd never had an orange before?
I mean, she takes a bite and then, like, grabs it out of her mouth and throws it to the side. So I guess she bit the peel off.
Okay, that's weird.
That is very weird.
Yeah, I don't care for that at all.
The first time I saw that, I was like, what is she doing? I grew up in Central Florida where there are orange trees, you know, everywhere, and I know how to eat an orange, and I have never seen any. I'm an orange eating expert. I have never seen anyone do it like that before.
I was actually confused when the doctor later, like, has an orange, and I was like, oh, I just assumed that was an apple tree because I watched someone pick a fruit and take a bite out of it. So my brain was like, apple. I refuse to even acknowledge that happened.
Are you trying to compare apples and oranges? Oh, come on.
Here's another thing. Like, she didn't, like, wash it or anything. It's
also, like, are they on Earth? She doesn't know.
She
could maybe have it's an orange.
So poisoned.
That's true. It may be an orange. It could just look like an orange.
Maybe it's some space orange that's poisonous.
Maybe it's alien eggs, and she just ate someone's offspring. Lucky for her, it's actually an orange with a suspiciously thin rind on it. But there's a cute scene not too long after this where, after she's been kidnapped, I'm sorry to jump ahead, and the doctor is asking people, have you seen a girl? She's about this tall, may have orange juice running down her chin. That's so cute.
She does get kidnapped really quickly. She gets kidnapped by these robed people, the cult, basically. And the doctor immediately catches them taking her and says, hey, stop that.
Hey, excuse me. Could you not?
This one robed guy very slowly walks up to him, slowly raises his arms above his head as if to attack him, and then the doctor just turns him a flip.
It's like, let me get into proper position for you to throw me over your shoulder.
Doctor tells him to put her down. They do, but as they're putting her down, they bop him over the head with a very large rock.
That was awesome. I was like, you're not really going to pay attention to what's going on behind you at all? You kind of deserve to get hit over the head.
I also have to say, Elizabeth Sladen is really good at going limp. Like, when they're dropping her on the ground.
She's very trusting.
When they put her on the ground, her, like, arm hits the ground and, like, folds in a way that seems like someone that's limp and not someone who's acting limp.
They probably hit her with a rock first. Like, on location, they're like, okay, assistant director, do you have your rock in hand? All right, Liz Sladen. So no acting required.
She requested it. It's part of her method.
Yes.
After this happens, the red spark that was inside the TARDIS opens the door and leaves and closes the door behind itself.
Wasn't that courteous? I mean, he wasn't raised in a barn.
It's flying away and it dips into the river. And this is a really good shot where like it hits this like body of water and like the water like steams right where it gets hit. Like,
yeah, it'll kind of crash into things and the things will spark, which is really impressive for what is basically an overlay.
Oh, yeah. I thought it was really cool.
And the doctor is heading towards, after he's awoken from his rock nap, he's walking towards this guy who's like shoveling hay. But as he's heading toward this guy, the spark hits him, hits the guy with the hay, and causes him to die. He gets like fire exploding.
Combust?
Combusts a little bit. Yeah, he's like smoking and blue?
And blue.
And I'm not sure why. He said it was like oxidation or something like that that made him go blue. But then the red spark just, I guess, flies off to go do more Ghost Rider murdering. I got to give props to Chris Cherry for reminding me of the PBS show Ghost Rider. Okay, so Giuliano is studying the stars with a telescope, and he's just sort of hanging out with Marco.
Yeah, they're buddies.
We need to talk about this.
Yes.
Because he's technically a duke, but there are other parts in the script where he refers to himself as prince. He doesn't have a duchess, he doesn't have a princess, but he has Marco, who he introduces as his companion.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
They're in a relationship.
Oh, yeah. For clearly. Sure. That's kind of progressive for, you know, 1970, whatever it is, 6, 5, something. It's very interesting.
I was, like, shipping it immediately. I think Chris Cherry called Marco Hot Twink Napoleon Dynamite.
Oh.
I like that.
It's not wrong.
It is descriptive.
There's one part where Giuliano asks Marco something, and he kind of looks over at him, and it's this, like, sort of slow, lingering look. And I'm like, dude, they're just, like, burning the screen up. So maybe it actually wasn't in the script. Maybe it was just those two.
They just decided.
The actors were just, like, hot for each other or something. And it just bled over into their characters.
And it also seems like there's, in the script, in the episode, it seems like they were trying to have a little bit of a romance between Sarah Jane and Giuliano. But, like, none of that works as well as it does Giuliano and Marco.
Not at all. Not at all. And you know that Giuliano ain't having none of that. He's like, I got my missus. I'm all right. You know? But, I mean, it's cute because if that is the case, and it certainly appears that that is the case, the fact that it isn't acknowledged means that all the other characters are just, you know, cool with it. It is what it is, so it isn't an issue. It's not like Federico is trying to get rid of Giuliano because of this. You know, it's just an unstated, accepted sort of thing. So it seems to me, if that was the case, and I'm sure it must be because they wouldn't have those two characters. I mean, there's no point in Marco really at all, except that he is Giuliano's companion. And so it has to be on the mind of whoever, of the writer who's doing this. And so the fact that it isn't played up, I think, is so great.
They're just pals.
Possibly.
Maybe.
Doubtful.
It is possible. I mean, it is possible that they grew up together and met each other in kindergarten and have been best friends since, when, you know, but yeah, if that were the case, they wouldn't call him his companion.
I'm 100% for this relationship, so.
We should get the two of them at a con together and just see if they still have the smoldering looks that they cast to each other every once in a while.
I was going
to
say you could cosplay them, but they don't really have, like, very distinctive outfits necessarily.
No.
But those haircuts.
That's true.
That's true. It's all in the wigs.
I actually already have a bob wig, so that'll work. I just need to find my Tim Pigott Smith.
He's out there, man. He's out there. Don't ever give up.
No slide against you, Tony.
Thanks.
Hieronymus? I'm still pronouncing it wrong, aren't I?
You know what? Whatever you say, just commit to it 100% and no one will question you.
Exactly.
Ronnie comes in.
There you go. But now people will think it's Kate O'Mara, so.
Cool.
Hieronymus.
You got it.
I can learn the alphabet backwards. I can learn to say his name. Hieronymus.
I believe in you, man.
Hieronymus comes in and basically insinuates that Giuliano is going to die, right?
Yeah. He's like, Star said so.
Yeah.
So just so you know, like a heads up, you've got like 3 days to live.
Countdown starts.
But it's funny because Giuliano figures out, he's like, oh, I know what you're about to say. You're about to say that I'm going to die next. He's like, I'm on to you, dude.
He's like, I don't buy any of this stuff. I've seen Hamlet.
I just saw him last week, in fact.
Real mess going down over there. So, yeah, then that's the scene where the, after that's the scene where the doctor asks this group of villagers about Sarah Jane, and they all run terrified because there's people coming up on horseback who are the, you know, the people who like to burn and beat up villagers.
Again, just for fun.
The doctor is very casual this whole scene, and I love him so much. And he's, they're like threatening him, and he's just like, I'm looking for somebody. And they've got like a sword on him, and he's like, hold on a second. And he like puts his fruit,
he's got
his
an orange,
on the end of the sword, digs around in his pockets, and pulls out a loud, like, noisemaker?
Like the kind you'd have on New Year's Eve.
Like a clack, 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 but huge. And it like clacks and like scares the horses, and like he like pushes someone off a horse and steals a horse with a giant clacker.
And an orange.
And an orange. Very versatile fruit. John Cleese warned me about people with fruit, so. This whole thing's really cool, but ultimately pointless. Because he's riding off on his horse, and one of the, I'm just going to call them guards, because that's the role they fill, tackles him off of the horse and knocks him out. So.
But it looked cool, man.
It did look cool.
Those stunt doubles, man, they did a great job. It looks fantastic.
There's some really good choreography in this, as well as some really bad choreography. It's a good mix.
And when you say that, I immediately think of an example for each one.
I mean, we've already had one piece of, I think, kind of bad choreography, which is the guy just slowly coming up and raising his arms.
Preparing to be flipped.
But this little number right here is pretty great. We got some more good and bad coming up, so we'll let you know when we get there. So Sarah Jane is going to be made a sacrifice for this cult.
I hate when that happens.
Well, that's what companions did in the 70s. They got sacrificed to strange cults.
And they have to be put in a large white robe.
I've never understood this. Why can't they just stab them in the chest with whatever clothes they happen to be wearing?
I'm always impressed that they have it in their size. If I ever, like, got sacrificed, they'd be like, oh, we weren't prepared for somebody. Like, hang on a minute. It's going to take us a minute to, like, make some alterations.
Well, it always takes these sacrifices,
how,
like...
That's how I'm going to not die.
Forever. So maybe they are, like, taking it in.
And I think it's in this scene, I think it's this one, where is one of the other examples of really bad choreography, where the priests are sort of, like, dancing around the altar kind of thing, and they do this move where they, like, walk up the steps to the altar, and then walk back down off of the altar, and then they walk back up the steps to the altar. It's so silly. I'm like, who came up, not on the show, like not like what movement choreographer came up with, but thinking of it as an actual cult of Demnos, when did that practice originate? You know, like, was it the previous century? And what purpose does it serve?
It's to keep the congregation from getting bored.
Improve circulation.
Yeah.
It's really just for the exercise. I will say, I like the masks that they all have. Mm-hmm. Everybody's is slightly different. They didn't just, like, make one and then copy it a whole bunch of times.
Or it looks like maybe they did and then just badly copied it every time. It's like a Xerox of a Xerox. They're all, like, sort of smushy-faced. But, I mean, good, but
yeah,
they are slightly askew and terrifying.
Which is basically what you want out of a mask. Just slightly not like a face.
The doctor gets taken to Count Federico, the uncle, and the doctor sort of tries to warn them about, you know, how he unleashed a spark on all these people and it needs to be stopped.
But why does he do it in a way that he knows no one's going to believe him?
I think just so he can be mad about it later.
That's possible.
So he can be like, I showed up, said a bunch of crazy things, and nobody will let me help them. How rude.
They're like, well, if you are like a sorcerer or whatever, we already have one, by the way. He's great. Have you seen his beard?
And his chemistry set?
And they're basically like, let's have a little sorcerer off, basically. Foretell my future. And the doctor just sort of like fucks around with him because that's what he does. He's like, I can't do it because it's like, I have a different mode
of
doing it than
you.
He's
like, I can't tell your future because there won't be one if you don't listen to me.
Oh, he does say that, yeah.
Cheeky doctor.
But there's also like, he's being quizzed as well. And, like, just giving joke answers, basically. And says, I can teach you my way. You just have to have a glib tongue.
Being quizzed about the stars.
Yeah.
And he's like, doesn't matter. That's not real anyway.
And meanwhile, the spark has also killed another guard. Not very important, but it happens.
Well, just to show that it can still do it. I haven't killed anybody in a couple of scenes. I think I need to do that.
And now it's time for the doctor to be killed as well. He's taken away to be executed. He gets down on his knees and they're going to swing a big old sword at his head. And that is the cliffhanger. And that is the end of episode one. We are now into episode two, which I have called The Cult of Dimnos, which you've already mentioned. I pronounced that one right, right?
Yes.
All right.
I'm telling you, just commit to it. Just Dimnos. Commit to it and go. No one will question you.
No, they'll just yell at me later. So the doctor, they're about to swing the sword, and the doctor holds up his hand and says, excuse me, hold on 1 second. I want to look fashionable for my murder, and takes off his scarf. And then he uses the scarf, and it is very effective.
He, like, whips it around the sword and, like, throws the sword away.
He actually whips it around the guy's foot.
Oh, you're right. He does.
And then flips him.
Impressive.
And then steals another horse and gallops away.
That's two horses he's stolen so far.
He's a serial horse thief. But he doesn't stay on it very long. He jumps off of it fairly quickly and, like, smacks it so it'll go away, I guess, to, like, they'll follow the horse and not him, I guess. Well, hear the horse and follow him, and he'll be going in a different direction. But there's a sort of a chase scene. He's running through a market and being chased. And that's one thing that I kind of don't like about the serial. There are a handful of scenes that are a little bit dragged out. There's a good handful of shots of just people walking places.
Shots that last just a little bit too long.
Which is odd for a four-parter. Generally, I don't have pacing issues with four-parters. Usually these things happen in six or more parters. But like, there's a good handful of just like killing time in this serial.
It's interesting because once you get up to Peter Davison, they sort of do away with the whole concept of six-parters. So they have an extra four-parter and a two-parter. Usually his historical stories are the ones that are relegated to the two-parter. So they're really tight. They're really quick. There's no wasted time in them. When I was watching this one a couple nights ago, it really reminded me of a couple of Peter Davison's historicals, except for the length over which it happens. There's a lot of escapes and getting captured again, and then you escape and get captured again. And I really think that you could have trimmed this down to a really good, solid two-parter.
I could see that.
I mean, a three-parter at least, but that wasn't part of the pattern that they were doing at the time. But, man, this would make a great two-parter. I just don't think it's enough to quite stretch out to four.
But, yeah, because when it's not being slow, it's being really good.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites from that period.
Oh, so, yeah, this is when the sacrifice starts to happen. Now, you're talking about their little choreography. Not only that, but they throw, like, flower petals onto, like, the sacrificial dagger. So
nice.
It's a little pillow.
It's pleasant.
Because they're sending whoever their victim is to their eternal sleep. So they have to give them a pillow upon which to rest their head.
It would be so much quicker if bad guys would just kill people.
Just kill them. I know.
I just wish I could be a bad guy one time, because I would do it properly. I would get stuff done. All these bad guys, terrible. Terrible at management. Time management, especially. Anyway.
I'm frightened.
But where's the fun in being evil if you can't gloat and if you can't make a ceremony out of whatever it is you're trying to accomplish?
I guess. But I think that's the bad guys. That's their downfall, is that they're so into that aspect of it. That doesn't get anything done.
How else does good have time to beat them and win if they don't drag out their process?
That's my point exactly.
Oh, I totally understand. But see, it's like a symbiosis going on here.
You can't just be a good bad guy and like win all the time.
That'd be boring.
Yeah.
I guess. So the doctor has snuck into the lair, the catacombs
this is
of
like
death.
One of my favorite scenes, because so they're doing their very ornate ritual thing, right? At the end of it, the guy like raises his dagger up. And is holding it there, and is holding it there, and is holding it there. And the doctor, like, yanks Sarah Jane away. She, like, slides away from the table that she's on. And then the guy brings the dagger down? Like, he didn't see that happen.
Well, okay, first off, he's wearing a mask.
Okay.
And
that's fair.
He's looking straight up. He's got limited viewpoint to begin with. If you wear a mask, you don't have, a very good,
peripheral
vision, yeah. So it's plausible.
All right.
And again, you take too long.
But did nobody else see it?
That's true. Maybe they're like, Was this a new part of the ritual?
Maybe they're in deep prayer, so their eyes are closed.
They're all too embarrassed to ask.
Everyone's down for killing her, but they don't want to watch it.
That's true.
You know? They don't want to see the blood and gore. The head of the cult here, he's slightly different. He's got a shiny purple robe. I think it's...
That's how you know he's the leader.
Yeah, because he's bright purple. Spoilers, he turns out to be...
Commit to it.
Come on.
Hieronymus?
There you go.
Ah!
Look at that.
I'm growing.
That is hilarious.
Before we find that out, after the doctor takes Sarah Jane away, the spark arrives. The red orb comes down and does weird stuff to Hieronymus.
It kind of becomes like an orange beam, yeah. And it speaks to him.
In a very deep voice.
Orange is kind of a theme in this one. There's a repeating motif.
The Mandragora energy is basically like talking to Hieronymus like, "You are my number one guy."
And another thing, if this had been a two-parter, he would have been able to speak much more quickly. I really think he spoke as slowly as he did just to fill time.
I mean, it's so obnoxious that the doctor makes fun of it.
He also is basically saying, like, I'm going to give you powers and stuff, too, right?
Yeah, I like his little instructions because it's like, you have to stand right here to talk to me. No one else can stand right here. If anyone else stands right here, they'll die. And I just like, we were watching that, and it's like, you all heard that, right? I'm supreme in charge. Beam said so. All right.
And the doctor knows about this cult because he's headed off with Sarah Jane. But the cult was supposed to have died out ages ago, but I guess they're still around secretly. And they also talk a bit about the Mandragora in energy and all that and how bad it's going to be. They basically have a little exposition scene in these catacombs, which, by the way, one of the original titles for this serial was The Catacombs of Death.
That is a classic serial title if I've ever heard one.
Just put of death at the end of anything and you're golden.
I really think more of the story would have had to take place in the catacombs if that were going to be the story title.
To be fair, the mask only really happens in the last episode.
Well, that's true. You got a good point. But there are masks throughout. Not the mask in this term of like the dance, but the use of masks go on throughout the whole story.
None of the masks are particularly... of Mandragora.
Actually, that's a good point. I hadn't thought of that before. The masks, that just happened to relate in some indistinct way to Mandragora.
That's my favorite cereal.
The more we say Mandragora, it's starting to sound like a breakfast cereal.
Does it taste like oranges?
Yes.
I think it's in after the rescue, the catacomb scenes, Sarah Jane suddenly has this realization, wait a minute, I've been traveling with you for like 2.5 seasons now, and it just occurred to me that I can understand different, it never occurred to me that I could understand aliens when they talk, but now that we're in Italy or wherever, how can I understand Italian?
That actually comes up later, but yes.
Is it later?
Yeah, it's after, it's because it's a clue to something.
After she gets hypnotized. Yeah. Because that's the doctor's tip-off that she's been hypnotized. Because like, You've never once thought to ask that. So I realized your mind must have been altered in some way.
You've thought to ask a question, so clearly you are hypnotized. They get caught by guards because they're just sitting there ignoring what's behind them. They get taken to Giuliano and Marco. And Giuliano and the doctor immediately become science buds.
Science best friends.
Because he knows the doctor because he was there for the whole scene with Federico. So he's like, you sound like a man of science. I'm a man of science. We should be men of science together. And he shows the doctor the dead guard that got sparked. And that's when the doctor's like... It's the helix energy and oxidation and other science terms. Meanwhile, Federico has ordered a search for the doctor, but also his sort of henchman guy, I don't know his name or if he even has one, gives him a list of people that are going to show up to hang out with Giuliano at the mask. And it's a list of all very, like, important people. Leonardo da Vinci being one of them.
He invited a bunch of thinkers.
It's a shame that we didn't get to see any of those.
Right? They keep talking about him.
There's like a couple of extras in the background when we get to the actual mask in part four that it said that that's who they, but you never see any of them really. You just hear about them. They get referred to as they're off screen or whatever.
Yeah, they're very MacGuffin-y.
There's a point where the Doctor is also disappointed. He's like, I'm never going to meet Leonardo da Vinci. Ugh.
Actually, yeah, I was going to say give it a few seasons, but even in that one, he doesn't meet him. Never mind. Spoilers.
I kind of like that. They should bring that back. Just the Doctor's, because the Doctor's met like everyone. So it's nice that there's always just this one guy. He just, for whatever reason, never gets a chance to hang out with.
I mean, even Captain Janeway met him, sort of, on the holodeck. There was a whole thing about her setting up shop in his studio and basking in his... It was a really great scene. Anyway, tangent number... I've lost count.
I think this is just a podcast of tangents. That's what we do. Basically, Federico is going to use this list for evil purposes.
No, say it's not so. That can't be it.
Oh, maybe he's going to get them all a nice present, because he knows who they are now.
He can personalize his gifts.
Party favors, but he continues to yell at Hieronymus to kill Giuliano, and they're still sort of bickering about that. So Hieronymus sort of goes to the beam of light to sort of ask for help. Help me with killing this guy?
Yeah, he wants some powers.
The beam doesn't really help that much.
No, he's like, we're going to give you powers.
Time. Yeah.
When we want to.
The time isn't right. Just hold on a little bit. We got 4 episodes to get through. And also, we sort of get this scene where the guy with the white hair, who's also in the cult, Hieronymus is like the leader of the cult, but he's like second in command in a way, has a scene where he's talking to him. And it's like, basically he says, it seems like this isn't the first time that you've talked to the Mandragora thing. And sort of Hieronymus gives this like backstory of he was sort of talked to earlier in his life. And like, he's been looking forward to this moment for a very long time, sort of thing. Like,
it shows him.
He's part of its plan.
So when did that happen? How did the Helix make contact with him in the first place? If it had to travel by TARDIS to get there this time, how did they encounter each other the first time?
Maybe it's a sort of situation like, I'm just spitballing here, but like in the Three Doctors, the way like Omega could like, he was stuck there, but he could sort of like reach out in a way. Maybe Mandragora was throwing its voice.
That's a possibility.
Psst, I'm Dimnos. I'm going to help you out later, buddy.
When the time is right.
When I can trick this Time Lord into bringing me here. I don't know. There's some holes.
But honestly, not many. It's a pretty straightforward story. It's pretty well done. Just that one little thing.
But the next scene we do get is the Doctor and Sarah Jane and Giuliano sort of talking about it. And like, why have they chosen... Like, what's going on? Why are they here now and all this stuff? And the Doctor's like, they're using this sort of mythology of Dimnos and using this specific time period to their advantage. They're basically, because people are more, like, what's the word I'm looking for? Not suspicious. That's the wrong word.
Gullible? Susceptible? Man. Naive? I've given you 3 really good words.
None of them are the one I'm looking for, though. Superstitious? And like, it's also like people are scared and all that stuff. So it's a very good time period to sort of take advantage of these people.
I do really like, there's this conversation that happens when they first have that body that's all blue. The one guy's like, yeah, everybody thinks it's,
a fire demon.
A fire demon. And he's like, I don't believe in fire demons. They're not real. They're not science. And when the Doctor comes in and explains it, he's like, so you mean it's a fire demon? And the Doctor's like, no, it's intelligent energy, and it's all very scientific. Kind of sounds like a fire demon to me.
Well, we've definitely had diamonds on the show before. D-A-E-M-O-N-S, or whatever that A-E symbol is called. But they're basically like, let's go check out these temple ruins. That's probably where all this stuff is going down. So they head out to go to that. And Federico is informed of where they're going. And is like, perfect. Well, I'm going to send some people there. They'll murder them. And then we can just say, it was a sacrifice. And we got there too late. Oh, but before the bad guys get there, Federico's guys get there to stop them. The Doctor goes into the ruins. Goes into the little area where the like slab is and the beam is, and like there's this really good, really nicely edited thing that I really like, where it basically there's this loud noise and it starts hurting the doctor's head, and like the camera's doing this thing where it's like he's doubling up and everything's vibrating and he's just holding his head in pain, and the sound is building louder and louder and louder, and then it cuts to a shot of a lake, and then the noise stops. And then just a rock hits the lake and it goes poink. And it was just like a beautiful, like beautifully edited scene. Just, oh, I loved it so much. It was like anti-climax. I loved it. It was great. It's like, duh, 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 poink. Because Sarah Jane is throwing rocks into a pond while Giuliano is being a huge nerd at her.
That's a cute scene, too, because he's like, all right, let me tell you about my absolutely wild theory about the Earth being round. And Sarah Jane's like, go on. She just lets him explain.
But he gets cut a little bit short when the guards show up to fight. And Sarah Jane runs away and runs into the ruins to find the doctor to warn him. But she gets caught by the cult members before she can find him. And that is the cliffhanger, is her being caught. It's the end of episode 2, and we're now into episode 3, which I have called The Endless Catacombs. Which I should have called it The Catacombs of Death.
Mm.
The sounds stop. I'm not entirely certain what was happening in this scene. He's sort of walking around the room. Bits of the wall keeps lighting up. I wasn't sure if there was like supposed to be entrances there, and he walks there, and then suddenly there's something blocking him. Or if there's just lights turning on randomly. I wasn't sure what the scene was.
It was very stagey. It was very theatrical.
And there's ominous laughter over all of it. But he just gets to a door and walks out, so I'm not sure. Maybe that seemed like another scene that was slightly padded.
Oh, yeah.
There's like 4, maybe 5 guards sword fighting Giuliano, and they must really suck. Because it's 4-on-1, and he is kicking their ass.
Until the doctor starts helping, and that's when he gets stabbed.
That actually is some decent, there is some decent choreography there of the 4-on-1 fight, though. There's like this great bit where they all like pile on top of him, and then he just flings them all off at once. And I was like, oh, that's a really nice shot. I like that. Federico is just pulled up on his horse, and Giuliano's like, you have to send an army to fight me? Federico's like, what's wrong with you guys? It's 4-on-1. And the doctor rushes out with his sword, and he's like, you can't count. Count? Nerd. I love him so much. But yeah, then he starts helping, and immediately Giuliano gets stabbed. He was doing so well by himself. I think the doctor threw off his game. But then the cult members come out and start fighting the guards. Not sure why.
They're all up in their cult business. I don't like it.
Yeah, but they could have just waited till they killed the doctor and Giuliano, then went in. Killed 2 birds with 1 stone. But the doctor and Giuliano take this opportunity to run away. They go into the temple. And the doctor gets to be a doctor, and doctor up Giuliano, and name drop both Florence Nightingale and Cleopatra. So Federico goes home and pouts. Almost every scene with Federico where he's at his quarters, there's always like a servant tending to him. You know, like he's got maybe some wounds in this scene and they're like cleaning him up. Or he's like, there's someone like doing his eyebrows or his hair or something in one scene. Someone putting gloves on him. Like, there's a servant doing some menial sort of thing in almost every scene.
Yeah, there's one who's like, I don't know, fussing with his shoes or something.
Oh, yeah, like lacing up his boots and
stuff.
Yeah,
and he like finally, he gets fed up and he's like, well, you're done. Get off. And like kicks him away.
I'm sure he gets fed.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure he can't like feed his own body with food, even oranges. Someone has to do it for him. But I mean, if you're a count and you've got staff and peasants and stuff, I mean, you're going to show off a little bit. You're going to use them for everything.
Yeah, you don't want to waste them. They're there. Might as well.
Give them something to do.
Remind them who's boss.
But he's really grumpy because the guests are starting to arrive and he's supposed to go greet them. But he's like, tell them I'm sick.
He's also irritated that the guests are there at all, because it makes it more difficult to, you know, carry out all his murders.
So this is the point where Hieronymus hypnotizes Sarah Jane. The doctor's companions are very susceptible to hypnotization.
And Sarah Jane, too. For the strong, independent woman that she is, she really got hypnotized a lot. and mind-controlled and stuff.
Like, she's, like, full-on bloodthirsty after this, basically. Because he's like, kill the doctor for me. And she's like, cool, you're my master now. The doctor and Giuliano find her in the catacombs. And that's when the whole scene happens where she's like, why do I know Italian? Because the doctor says something in Latin. And Sarah Jane's like, what is that? And Giuliano says, oh, it's Latin. It means whatever it means. And then she's like, huh, wait, why do I understand Italian? Which honestly is a fair question that's never been asked by anybody on this show before for 14 seasons.
Mm-hmm. When do we actually get the first explanation?
He gives a sort of explanation later, which is that it's a Time Lord's gift. So, but it's also partially the TARDIS, right? I mean, that's not said in this serial, but...
Yeah, what we know now is that it's like the telepathic circuits of the TARDIS.
I wonder, when does that piece of knowledge slip in?
Well, I don't know. I might be wrong, but the first one I remember is the second Eccleston episode.
Oh, wow. Oh, so wow. It's like New Who.
I can't remember if it's been said more specifically prior to that, other than this time where he says it's a gift of the Time Lords or whatever. He says, you know, nebulous explanation. But Eccleston tells Rose, and she's like, wait, how can I understand aliens? And he's like, well, it's the TARDIS. It gets in your head. It changes the way that you think. And she's like, your machine, it just gets in my head without even asking me. So that's the first time that I think that it's really explicitly said that it's the TARDIS does it.
And the doctor just took credit for it.
Oh, yeah, of course.
We've had Federico be kind of, he hasn't been very threatening so far. He killed the Duke, but he's been kind of like mopey and whiny and meh. But this scene that happens between him and Hieronymus is so good. Basically, he comes in and Hieronymus is sitting down and he's like, forgive me if I don't stand for you. Federico says, only the dead fail to stand for me, and like pulls a sword on him. And he's like, oh, I'm up. And he's just like, listen, my knees were a little achy.
What he actually says is he's like, I was so worried with love for you. I've been worried about you. So that's why I couldn't stand up.
He's also like, you need to be careful and worried. He's like, there are plans against you or whatever. And he's like, the only plans there are mine. And they're going well. Okay, so he's like, yeah, just talking about like how his reading astrology stuff is bullshit. And he's like, you can't even read my chamber pot. Which earlier we also had a mention of in the catacombs that there are basically bat droppings the height of a man, twice the height of a man. It's like this episode is very into poop. We got Batshit Mountain and this chamber pot reference.
I mean, that's two things.
That's more than one, Tony. We talked about the doctor stealing two horses.
That's true.
Obviously, you can count.
Then the doctor sort of finds out about Leonardo da Vinci, and he's very worried that a new dark age is going to happen because we might lose da Vinci and all the thinkers and all that.
They've invited all like the important people all in one place, and the doctor thinks maybe that's part of the plan. Wipe them out, people who would push humanity forward way back.
Oh, I forgot that also Hieronymus told Federico that he was going to die, that it's been prophesied. That's in the star chart.
There comes a point where it's like, everybody's going to die. Everybody who's not Hieronymus, you're doomed.
That's true. My star chart says that too.
But this funny thing is that you just can't say that to the guy who's basically been hiring you to do all these assassinations, because he knows what's up. He knows if you say the stars say you're going to die, the stars didn't really say anything. There's going to be some poison in your drink. So that just wasn't a smart move on his part, I don't think.
So, but Federico goes to check in on some torture of Marco, because Marco's been captured.
Because to just check in on the torture. Just
see how it's going. You need anything? You needed some water? But he's basically trying to convince Marco to betray Giuliano.
He would never.
Oh, no.
But he's basically trying to get him to say that Marco is part of this cult of Dimnos, and then that will make people not like Marco, because nobody likes a cult.
Unless it's the cult, the band.
Yeah, that's fine.
I mean, yeah, sure.
Cult films are fine, just not actual cults. But Marco replies to this appropriately. He just spits in his face. It was so hard for me every time that they like holler out for Marco to not just say polo every time. I say it was hard not to, but I did it. I did it every time.
Did you?
I did. Very quietly.
I was going to say, I didn't notice.
Because I know it's annoying. So the doctor is sneaking around and finds Hieronymus. Hieronymus throws this thing in a pot and it goes poof. And smoke pours out of it. And the doctor utilizes this. He like rushes up and like pokes his head up like, boo, good evening. But then he's just sort of like semi-threatening him, talking to him, trying to figure out what's going on. Messing around with his mask. While he's doing all this, he's not aware that Sarah Jane is coming up behind him with the murder weapon that Hieronymus gave her.
It's basically like a very large pin.
Yeah, I think it might be covered in poison.
It has to be.
And she like goes to stab him, but he grabs her. And that's when he's like, hey, don't do that. I'm your best friend.
Because they're best friends. They love each other so much.
And that works. She stops being hypnotized. And then, but while
because they love each other so much.
True love conquers all. While he's distracted, dehypnotizing her, Hieronymus sneaks up behind him to attack him. But the doctor, like, full on kicks him in the face. Like, jump kicks him. It's amazing. But he runs off, and then the guards chase Hieronymus down. But he gets away. The guards have also taken Giuliano, taken him to the dungeons with Marco. They're reunited. But it's sad because they're in a dungeon.
Also, Marco says, he's like, they made me say you're a part of the cult.
Yeah, so apparently it worked after he had a breaking point at some point, which is sad. I mean, come on. You knew that their love was strong, but it wasn't quite strong enough.
They can come back from this.
You think so?
Yeah. Well, because also captured is the doctor and Sarah Jane. And Sarah Jane just tried to murder the doctor, and they're fine.
Well, but she was hypnotized.
Well, he was tortured.
Well, I know. I'm just sad that their love wasn't pure and forever. I don't know. I'm being silly.
Well, they say that, back to the hypnotism, you're not supposed to be able to be hypnotized and do something that you wouldn't be willing to do. Unhypnotized.
Cool. Okay. But, like, if you live with the doctor for a real long time, you probably want to kill him, like, a little bit. There's at least some small part of you that's like, yeah, all right.
And the only reason you don't is because you don't know how to fly the TARDIS yourself.
I'm not getting stuck in medieval times. I don't know. Let's not stop some companions who are just like, I found a boy.
Right.
Some more ritual stuff happens with Hieronymus. He starts getting powers in his hands, which is smoky hands.
It's the right time.
All the rest of the cult are coming up and getting their hands stamped as well with the fire of Dimnos. They can get back in later because they have the stamp now.
Right.
The doctor basically says, like, you need to stop this cult. They're getting powerful and it's bad, bad, bad stuff. And Federico is like, I don't know if I buy this, but I'm going to check it out. But I want you to come with me. So he takes the doctor with him. Also, I believe the doctor tells him straight up that it's Hieronymus. Federico's like, I'm not sure if I buy that, but let's go check it out. Because Hieronymus has been a dick to me lately, so. And then they go, they get to the ritual, and Federico goes to confront Hieronymus, calls him a traitor, and rips his mask off. But he ain't got no face.
Yeah, he's just a glowing orb of energy.
And his beard's gone.
His beautiful beard.
It's like he went to shave his beard and shaved too much.
Just
got the whole face. And then he force lightnings Federico, presumably killing him. And that is the cliffhanger. A guy we don't care about gets murdered. That's the end of episode 3. We're now into episode 4, which I've called Swallow the Moon.
Gross.
Because that's what happens. They sort of go back into ritual mode and they all dance and say that things are going to go bad when the moon is swallowed, basically. It's like some fancy language going on.
Which at some point the doctor is explaining that to Sarah Jane, that they said it's going to happen when, they give some name. When something swallows the moon. And Sarah Jane's like, hey, I came here with you. I know science and shit. Why are you condescending to me? And he was like, no, that's what they said. That's what I know. I'm trying to figure it out too.
The doctor actually joins up with the the cult members when they're doing their dancing and stuff, and then for a little bit, like, I'm part of you, and then slips out. And he goes back and tells everybody that Federico is dead, and this is all true, and don't kill Giuliano, which they were about to do.
Well, basically, also, more importantly, his uncle's dead, which makes him the Duke.
I think he was the Duke to begin with, wasn't he? That's why he wanted Giuliano dead.
I don't think he wasn't old enough. And so, technically, he was giving orders, because at this point, he's like, he's rightful heir, like, all, and, like, the guards go from, like, being ready to execute him to being like, well, you can't, because he's in charge now. And they're like, oh, shit, you're right.
Yeah, it was a really quick transition. They're so fickle, those guards.
And they all get set free, and Marco is immediately like, I'm ready to fight. Let's go fight him. The doctor has to be like, calm down. Let's think this through. Let's fortify the castle.
You guys don't have force lightning powers, so.
Yeah. Which we don't actually see them use that power very often.
No, it happens a lot off screen where they're like, oh man, they're killing everybody. It's real bad, you guys.
Although it seems weird that they're having a party with all of this going on. How did they get the guests into the castle without, like, being stopped by the cult and everything?
I mean, they were already there.
They were already there?
Yeah, they had arrived earlier in the story, I believe.
I feel like this, if this was New Who, there'd be more concentration on that group of people. We'd actually get to see them.
And, like, meet a few of them and stuff.
Yeah, and know more about them other than just overhearing where they're at.
A lot of stuff in Classic Who takes place in dialogue. You're told that all the citizens of a planet are revolting against their leaders or whatever. You never see it. You know, it's the theater background where you have a certain cast and that's what you have. And everything else that happens has to come to you through the dialogue of that cast. And plus you have to pay extras if you have more people in it.
But it is this real interesting thing where it's like all these people are already here and we have like an uprising going on. Do we just continue with the party? And they're like, yes.
I mean, you don't stop a party. Come on.
He's like, they basically decide that, like, we can hold them off long enough that, like, nobody here even knows what's going on.
Also, if you cancel the party, people think you're chicken. So, but that is also at this point that the doctor figures out that the moon swallowing is an eclipse. He's doing astrology. Sarah Jane helps him with the maths because he's like, what's something times something? And she tells him. And I thought it was a really cute moment where she gets to help him out. But he's like, realizes what time it is and all that stuff. And he's like, it's an eclipse. That's what it's going to be. And that's going to be the cue for the cult to strike. They're going to strike during the mask, basically. Okay, so Giuliano comes in to ask the doctor whether or not he should hold the party or not. But he's interrupted his thinking. So the doctor is just very quiet and just like staring, which is something Tom Baker is good at. And then he immediately just goes like, launches into like full on plan mode. He's like, oh, I'm gonna do this, like really fast and just like all of a sudden. And he is super down for them having the party. He's like, that is a great idea. We should do it. I'm gonna wear a costume.
He gets this giant lion head.
Yeah, it was so odd.
It's amazing.
Giuliano is not the most decisive character. Like, he's really good with a sword. We saw that. But when it comes to actually being a duke, he wasn't that great at it. You know, even, like, Marco had to be like, look, dude, you're the duke. Get it together.
He's very Hamlet-y. I wonder if that all... Because there is definitely a lot of, like, Hamlet-esque things. I wonder if that was intentional or just accidentally doing it.
It's so ingrained that it just naturally happens anytime you do a period piece.
That's just what it was like back then.
Hamlet was just a snapshot of everyday life.
Sarah Jane gets a dress. That's not what happens next. It's just really important.
Well, the doctor gets his outfit first. She brings him the lion costume. And I think it's great because he puts it on and he's actually doing the lion's roar and everything. And Sarah Jane is so not into it.
She's very unimpressed with him.
She's like, why are you making jokes? Stop it. She's basically like, are you making jokes because you're really scared right now?
And the doctor's like, mm-hmm.
No, maybe, yes.
When they do sort of the same thing in Pyramids of Mars, the doctor really conveys that this is a serious situation. Yes, I'm making jokes, but it's because this thing is so monumental that I don't know how we're going to beat it. This one, it just doesn't come across that way. He says it, yes, it's really bad, but it doesn't come across that way. He doesn't sell it.
But he is wearing a giant lion head, so that's something.
Probably undercut his point a little bit.
Maybe. So, but he has this plan that he's going to somehow drain the energy from the Mandragora energy. He's going to drain it. He's got this whole thing set up. And Sarah Jane's like, well, what if you're wrong? And he's like, when have I ever been wrong?
Oh my gosh, it's such like a sad, cute, funny moment where she just goes, all the time. But like really sad and worried.
So he goes out to the temple to set up some science stuff to drain the energy. And then we get a jester dancing. And he's like, he is cutting a rug. I was very impressed by his move. He's doing like flips and stuff.
Anytime I see a jester in like any kind of show or anything, I'm like, that's what Joe would be doing in medieval times.
He's juggling like things of flames.
I believe that's Stuart Fell, who's, you know, been sort of the lead stunt guy on Doctor Who for, you know, years at this point.
Oh.
He did all the stunt stuff in the John Pertwee period. So he's also quite a juggler and circus performer with his little backflips and fire eating and all that stuff. It's pretty awesome.
Nice. Very cool. He is very talented. How dare he?
I hate that guy.
I can do the juggling. But not things on fire.
When are you going to learn how to eat fire?
Yeah, come on, man.
I've heard it's surprisingly easy.
Okay, here's your job. For Hulanta this coming year, you are going to recreate Stuart Fell's routine for the cabaret.
Okay, listen, I can probably do the juggling. I can do the fire eating, probably. I cannot do flips. I make ungodly noises getting up off of the couch, so...
Okay, well, I will take a juggling act in the cabaret. You've signed up, by the way, just...
Oh, shoot.
No, I'm totally kidding. I would never do that.
I really want to do Sherna and Vorg.
We
Hulanta.
Really have to.
Oh, I would love to see someone do that.
The problem is I have no idea how to... Like, I could get mine. Like, I could buy it now. I have no idea how to go about making the jacket.
For Vorg.
Yeah.
He's got that, like Fruit Loop jacket. Fruit Loop sequins.
And I don't know how to sew or make things at all.
You can glue.
Ooh, that's a good point.
I think you could just make a jacket out of that material that those, like, sequin things. Like, you know, you get those pillows and you can, like, rub your hands across them. I think you could just make a jacket out of that.
I mean, you could. It wouldn't look like his jacket at all.
I think it would. Also, a clear bowler hat is hard to find as well.
You don't just find those on a rack at, you know, Joseph A. Banks.
But man, it'd be so cool.
We should do it.
We should.
We have time.
Yeah. It's in May.
You guys will be my best friends if you do Sherna and Vorg.
See, we got to do it now.
I've been wanting to see that for years.
We've put out a couple of posts like, hey, how do we do this?
And nobody else can figure it out either.
Like I said, Sherna's super easy. Like, it's
yeah,
all
I have. I have an Amazon wish list with most of the pieces just like waiting to be put into my cart.
Oh, nice.
We're going to do it. It's now on the podcast. We have to do
we
it.
We have to do it.
Or else we lose, I don't know, internet points. We lose the respect of our audience.
Ooh, we had that?
Well, if we do it, we will definitely gain the respect of our audience. Or at least Alan's.
Oh, that would never happen. Unlike Marco, I do not have a breaking point.
So the cult members are basically hanging out around outside of the party. Giuliano is informed of this by Marco, but he's
yeah,
like, don't worry.
They can't get into the castle.
Yeah, like, don't worry, we're fine. But we've also previously been told that Hieronymus knows of a secret entrance to the castle, so who knows if that's going to factor in. Spoilers, it does.
It super does.
It would be really a disappointment if it didn't.
Oh, and this is when we do get to see Sarah Jane in her new dress, and it's so pretty. I think we both audibly went when she came out in it. We were like very excited.
So excited at costume changes every time.
You'll be really disappointed when you get up to season 19 and 20 because the Doctor and the companions really don't change clothes.
Aw. What's the fun in that?
That's a bummer. You have like, I know there's a whole wardrobe in there.
Exactly. They never make use of it.
Just go in there and play around.
Oh, and also Sarah Jane has this adorable and hilarious line where she's worried, but she's like, not being with the Doctor is worse than being with the Doctor. And I'm like, aw, that's cute and funny. And then she dances, and there's some dancing, and it's really nice. This whole scene kind of reminds me of a little bit of The Girl in the Fireplace, visually, which I think is interesting because I feel like the cult of Dimnos, their aesthetic reminds me a lot of The Weeping Angels. I'm wondering if Moffat maybe was a fan of this serial.
Probably. That's a really good serial.
What part of it reminds you of Girl in the Fireplace?
The Victorian, like, dancing and all that stuff, the party.
Okay. Now, had a horse jump through a mirror, now, that would really set it up, but...
There is an awful lot of jumping on horses, though.
That is true.
Doctor rides a horse at least twice in this serial, just not very well.
Or through very anything. Long.
He does get tackled off of a horse, which is pretty cool. But the doctor goes to the temple, sets up the thing, sits down on the slab, sacrificial slab, and starts yo-yoing and whistling, as he does.
He's just killing time.
And Hieronymus... comes up and yells at him like, "Hey, you can't sit on that. That's not cool.
That's sacred. Yeah. You're defiling my stuff."
And basically gives the reasoning why, which we find out the reason why the Mandragora is being such a dick is that it doesn't want the Earth to progress to eventually get out and, you know, become the big honchos in space. They want to be the big honchos in space.
Yeah, it's kind of like in the future, humanity is like one of their only adversaries, I guess. Mm-hmm. Like, so we're just gonna stop that now. We're gonna send it back into the Dark Ages and just stunt their growth right here.
And the doctor's like, "Oh, that doesn't seem cool." But then Hieronymus starts shooting the doctor with his force lightning a lot. Repeatedly. Then we cut back and there's more dancing. And Sarah Jane sees the lion and assumes that is the doctor. But it's not. It is another one of those glowing faced things. And then we find out that the whole party's been infiltrated by the cult of Dimnos.
That's the problem with costumes. You make the assumption that the person underneath it is the one you know, but maybe it isn't.
And the doctor was pushing for the costumes, so a little bit his fault.
That's right. He's not perfect. Come on.
Then they start shooting everyone. The moon is being swallowed. Things are bad. The cult is supposed to be getting powers when the moon gets swallowed. Like, more powers. But the red spark arrives and
yes, they
kills
have they're all around the
sacrificial stone slab thing.
Yes,
where Mandragora has been hanging out as a beam. But they all like circle around it and are putting their hands on it. But then the spark arrives and then like basically kills all of them. Hieronymus was there as well, but it takes the purple robe off and it's not Hieronymus, it's the doctor.
Oh, they tricked me twice with the same thing.
He's basically like, I reversed the polarity of the slab and it like pulled the energy there and caused everything to explode and kill people. I killed all these people. And,
you're welcome.
Yeah. And then he starts doing an impression of Hieronymus and demands a salami sandwich and then gets a salami sandwich.
They give him a whole thing of salami. That's the most Italian thing right there.
There may have been a time in my life that I went into a deli and considered ordering a salami sandwich. But I figured they would just think I was stupid and not serve me anything. So I would probably just order turkey on rye. But it's funny, though, because that line, I literally haven't watched Mask of Mandragora in years and years. But I will be at Publix and I will see a salami and I will think of that line. I will think, I could use this to make a salami sandwich.
That is the lasting power of Doctor Who.
That is correct.
That's awful. Do you know how many salami sandwiches I eat? Now it's going to be stuck in my head forever.
Yeah, it's your go-to snack.
It is. God, I love salami.
Oh, you get what, like crescent rolls?
Yes, put them in the microwave for like a minute or two. And it gets all crispy like bacon.
Oh, I know what we're doing after this podcast.
There you go.
Salami sandwiches.
Oh, things about your podcast host that you hadn't learned in previous episodes.
But they basically, Giuliano's like, "Thanks for the help. Would you like to stay and help out more?" And the doctor's like, "No, I want to leave." And so they leave. They get out of there. The doctor, once again, is like, "I missed the Leonardo da Vinci, but it's cool." And said, I think he sort of hints that the Mandragora thing might be coming back at the end of the 20th century?
Yeah, that's right.
Did it come back? I don't think so.
In a novel, not on television.
Now I want to read the novel.
The show only went up to 89. Had they gone farther, had they actually gone to the end of the 20th century, maybe they would have done it.
That's actually kind of like wild that there's like that was like a kind of like a throwaway line and it's like they could have though, like yeah. It's been going on long enough that at some point we could have written that episode.
And they do some of that stuff later on in Colin Baker's time. They just didn't get quite far enough to do Mandragora, I guess.
They actually could do it now and have them go back in time and stop it. So it would have been like the future for that for that serial, but the past for now. That's interesting. The show's been on for so long.
So long!
But that's the end of the episode and the end of the serial. It's the end of The Mask of Mandragora. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back for final thoughts.
Hey, gang. Are you looking for another podcast to listen to? Well, you're in luck. The Nerdy Laser is a podcast, and we specialize in 90s nerd culture. But we don't leave anything out. If something is cool and nerdy, we will talk about it. So join myself, Richard Yule, and a variety of guests on the Nerdy Laser podcast, available on iTunes, Podbean, and the ESO Network.
And we're back.
All right.
Tony, you know what time it is?
No, I can't. I don't see the clock. Oh, it's 9:20.
Yes, but what time is it in the podcast?
In the podcast?
Yeah.
It's about like 1:50.
No, I mean, what do we do at this point in the podcast?
Normally you ask me what time it is, and then I spend about like 20 minutes not answering the question.
It's time for final thoughts.
Final thoughts!
My final thought is, Mask of Mandragora is a good story. It's solid. It's enjoyable. It's not terribly consequential. You know, it's not the kind of thing that in the new series you would launch a new season with. It was just a regular story that could have happened at any point in that season. It just happened to be the first one up. But it's good. It's fun. It's enjoyable. It's got a good, you know, love story between two guys. So, you know, that's always fun.
I really like the serial right at the beginning. Like I said, that cut between, like, the void, this just, like, random place you've never been before, straight to medieval ages, sort of. That's what's so fun about Doctor Who to me, is, like, it can go to all these different worlds, and when it does it all in one thing, that's always really fun. We've just had, like, a really solid string of serials, so it's like, yeah, that one was good. That one was good, too. That one was great. The show's been on a roll lately. The Doctor and Sarah Jane are adorable and continue to be adorable. Their relationship is so, like, easy at this point, and it's really fun to watch. This is a serial that had really good side characters. Sometimes you're like, oh yeah, there were other characters in this that weren't Team TARDIS. I forgot. This one had one that were really strong. Everybody was really cute. Or evil, or whatever they needed to be. But yeah, it was fun.
I agree. I think it was really good, really fun. I don't think it's quite at the height of the serials from last season, because last season was so solid. But it's still really good.
Mm.
It's not breaking any new ground, really, or anything. But it's solid. It's good. Yeah, I kind of wish it had maybe stuck around in the weird void area a little bit longer. Because I kind of was like expecting, oh, we're going to get like a weird, trippy serial. But it was only for just a little bit. I kind of would have liked a little bit more weird trippiness, but I do enjoy all the historical stuff as well. And like you said, the secondary characters were all great. The only like downsides I've have is like I would do wish we could have seen the party members a little bit more, or any at all. And the pacing was a little bit off here and there. But when it was going and when it was moving, it was really good and it was really solid. Oh, I liked it. Good serial. I'm like so pumped for this era. Like it's been pretty much nonstop good serials.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
And I didn't know when we first started watching. Like I knew 4 was very popular, and I didn't know if that was just because it's what aired here and what most people saw, and it was like, you know, a nostalgia factor. And I mean, sure, that's part of it, but like also, it's a really like all around solid era of the show. Just in a row, like quality wise. The bar is up there and it stays up there.
It is definitely seen as one of the golden eras of the show. And you're right in the middle of that period where you just left season 13, which is just amazing. And every story in it is so solid. Coming into 14, Mandragora isn't quite as strong, but the rest of the season just rocks. So you haven't, you're still in store for some great stuff.
I'm looking forward to it. Before we go, anything you want to plug?
A couple of things. My convention, Wholanta, coming up the first weekend in May next year. The one guest we have so far is John Davey, who is one of the creature performers on the new series. He's been working since 2006 and has done pretty much almost every episode since then. And he's the only on-screen performer to have been in Doctor Who, Torchwood, Sarah Jane, and Class.
Wow.
So he's got a lot of stuff to say, and he's a fantastic guy. So, you know, anybody interested can find more information about that at wholanta.com. And then I've got a few books out. The newest one being Children of Time, The Companions of Doctor Who, which is a collection of essays written by, with original artwork by about 80, 85 authors and artists, fans and professionals, covering 88 different companions from Doctor Who television, novels, comics, and audios. So you can find out about that at Cosmic Press, and that's Cosmic with K-O-Z. Of course, cosmicpress.com.
I believe previous guest Ashley Rayburn had a little something to do with that book too, right?
Yes, he wrote a chapter in it, and he also contributed interior artwork to my first book, Doctor Who's Greatest Hits, which I'm in the process of updating for the show's 55th anniversary to cover everything from the beginning up through the end of Capaldi. The updated version should be out soon. And Ashley's doing additional artwork for that.
We love him. He loves those Ice Warriors.
We just call him the Ice Warrior Expert.
You just wait till you get to the Horns of Nymon.
Yeah, I've heard we've got some interesting guests for that one.
Yes.
Guys, he'll be back. Both of you guys will be on it.
That'll be a fun one.
Oh, yeah.
And come to Atlanta, because that is really fun.
I'm looking forward to it next year.
Yeah. Come to Atlanta and, come say hi to us.
Yeah. If you like this episode, you can check out more on WatchYourRassalon.com. And be sure to rate and comment on our iTunes. It helps us out. If you leave a review, I don't know, iTunes likes it better.
It helps us get seen more.
Yeah.
And people are like, oh, my gosh, a Doctor Who podcast. I'm going to listen to it. And then they do, and they're like, this is great. Probably.
It's iTunes magic. If you'd like to help us out even more, you can go to watchyourasslon.com/support, and there you can find a link to our Patreon page, which you can get to just by going to patreon.com/watchathon, and there you can donate a monthly amount to get all kinds of rewards, like day early episodes, uncut video of the podcast records, bonus episodes, and live streams, where you can watch the episodes with us. It's a lot of fun. Also on our support page is a link to our Amazon wishlist, where you can sponsor an episode of the podcast by purchasing the corresponding serial on DVD for us. We'll mention you in the podcast and put your name on our Friends of Rassilon page. Speaking of, special thanks again to Matt Golden for sponsoring this episode.
Hey, thanks, Matt.
You can follow him on Tumblr at mgoldentumbles.tumblr.com. And I want to say a special thank you to Vincent E.L., for doing our theme song.
Thanks, Vince. We're sorry it took us so long for us to give you credit for the worst.
You can check out his website at swinglish.nu. And tune in next time when we talk about The Hand of Fear. We don't have any guests. It's just us on that one.
Ooh.
But keep calm and wrestle on.
Goodbye, and I love you.
You can say bye, too.
Okay, bye. No, thanks a lot for having me on. I really enjoyed it. You guys are amazing, and I can't wait till we do the next one. It's going to be fun.
I wouldn't even say no to a salami sandwich.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping through Amazon.com or the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.